Om Shanti. Welcome back. How many of you are meeting this lovely soul for the first time? Hand again, let him see how many. So quite a few. Okay, so this is our dear brother Charlie, who lives sometimes in Australia, but travels is shared responsibility for care of the Asia-Pacific region for the Brahmakumaris. So he's pretty busy because there's 17 countries in the Asia-Pacific region, and they're quite spread out, and they're very unique and very different one from the other. So Charlie's role is to offer care and support and sustenance for in all of those countries for the BK activities there. He's one of the first foreign brothers to study with the Brahmakumaris, and he's everybody's friend. That's pretty special, actually. That's a real blessing. So a warm welcome to Brother Charlie. I've asked Charlie if he would just speak, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 tips for all of his years with the Brahmakumaris, hosting so many retreats and events for regular BK students and for new friends, and what he sees as valuable when you're leaving a retreat, when you've been immersed in an experience like this, and then you're going home to your own place, your own country, the life you had before you came. What has he learned over the years is wise sort of guidance for you generally. And then we have 150 pieces of paper here. But the good news is they're divided into 8 main categories. So I will ask him your questions, the 8 main categories, okay? So welcome, Charlie, and thank you.
So thank you so much, Judy. It's really lovely to be here, be with everyone. And I've been meeting many over breakfast and dinner, and hearing how lovely your experiences have been being here. Is that true? Is everyone happy being here? That was a silly question, wasn't it? But really, I could feel just how hearts and minds have become so full. And sometimes I'm really touched by how a group of us can come together from such disparate corners of our world and create such an atmosphere. Don't you find that special? Mm. Because actually the atmosphere here is amazing, but all of us have co-created this atmosphere because of our elevated intentions to move forward spiritually. But, there's always a but, all of us will have to go home in a day or 2 or 3. And I think it's important to mentally prepare myself, because there's not one of us in this hall that won't have challenges when we get home. It's the nature of life today. So I feel it's really important to think, well, this experience I've had here, how can I carry it with me as much as possible? And you know, my experience of many of the peace of minds, in a way it's like a shift in priorities in life, and that's something profoundly deep. And that shift is around the balance I keep. We all have family, we all have work or activity responsibilities. But this shift is finding time for me. So I give time for family, time for work, and time for me. But it's a profoundly deep decision in life to say, I have to prioritize me, and it's not selfish. It's not a selfish thing to do, because I have to look after the self. And secondly, I think the approach to our spiritual life. Because sometimes we can come to an event like this, it's wonderful. We go home, we tell everyone we had one of the best experiences of life. But I get just a very absorbed back in home, at home, because to me we can treat it as a hobby, a discipline, or a lifestyle. A hobby means that what's really important is when I get back to work and all the real things of the world. But often we take up meditation as a discipline. We make that decision. But personally, I find today that often every morning we will wake, we will meditate, we will connect with those feelings. But as soon as we meditate, my mind reverts to its old thinking, its old perception, its old reality. So that's where the third sort of approach I find is to take on spirituality as a lifestyle. Meaning to put a little structure into every day, every day. And if I can suggest, in Australia we also have 4 retreat centers. I always say, practice every day for a few months and just see the effect on your life. Because living it as a lifestyle is like a decision. It's like a decision in a sense that I'm going to live as a peaceful soul. That's my sense of self. That's my sense of identity. And third thing, keep good company. So important. We have centers everywhere. And you know the collective atmosphere we've created. Each center has this atmosphere. And when you go to the centers, it helps you re-emerge the feelings that you've felt here. But fourthly, I feel to bounce back, because inevitably you'll go home, something's going to disturb you, something will upset you, and you know you might come crashing out of your little bubble, this wonderful little bubble you've created. And you know when you go sometimes into that dark place and you start to think, oh, I've lost it all, oh, you know, and you start to feel that those old feelings come back, a bit of hopelessness, etc. These feelings will come, and I feel we have to prepare not to sort of allow myself to be absorbed in them, but have a strategy really to bounce back quickly. And to me, no matter what, to keep practicing, and I think you'll establish more stability in your spiritual journey. So not to feel really heavy when you do sometimes just, you know, go back to the old feelings. And sometimes it seems worse than before because the contrast is greater. You know, you have the contrast of what you can be here. And when those old feelings of lack of self-respect, self-doubt, I'm not good enough, all the feelings that, you know, we're used to over a long, long time, kick back in, let me bounce back quickly. But that's just in essence.
Okay. That was essenceful. Thank you. Very good. Yeah, and I think it'll touch on many of the things that have been asked, actually, Charlie. You've begun very nicely because we have a whole set of questions here around integrating daily meditation into life. And I like what you've said about structure, a very simple structure. So even same time every day, I set aside 10 minutes to meditate. Not if I feel like it, but so the simple structure, which is nice. Some questions here about meditation in particular. So keeping it up when you get home, you've already offered that for structure. What to do when your mind keeps going over the same old things. Why is 4 o'clock such a good time for that early morning? Why isn't 5 or 3 okay? And a little bit even more detailed, how to integrate this practice and the BK learnings to heal trauma.
Gosh, how many questions were there?
Just one.
You know, at the heart of, I think, this whole week is one thing, at least for me, is to really establish a real, living, loving relationship with God, with the divine, with Baba. Because that's where power really comes. And to be really honest with you, these days I often don't even use the word meditation, because I find many people have a sort of a preconditioned idea that meditation is to sort of take your mind from a consciousness to another consciousness. And if I relax and feel calmer, I don't feel I've made this shift. So often I start to doubt, you know, I don't think I meditate well. You know, that sense. What I really love, what I've learned here with the Brahma Kumaris, is that we go about life observing what I remember. Because fundamentally, whatever I connect with, that's my experience. So if I connect with the past and we go into all those stories, we know that takes us into a dark place. Or if we connect with a person I'm not getting on well with. Because what we try to do here is remember God. Why? Because remembering is the most natural function of human consciousness. At every millisecond, you're remembering what you did or what you have to do or what someone said or whatever it may be. Because when I remember, three things are happening. I connect. Whatever I connect with will influence me. And whatever influences me, that's my feeling. And fundamentally, what we're learning here is to live in this world with all its challenges, all the personalities, all the situations. But rather than dwelling and remembering all those things, refocus and remember, connect and be influenced by that relationship that's absolutely stable and real. And of course, when we sit, we have to practice. But in a way, it's like going about my life under the influence of the most powerful relationship. Because sometimes I feel personally that, you know, we know where we want to go. Who feels that you sort of know you want to go to this place spiritually? I want to be more peaceful, more loving, etc. I think we all know that. But where do I get the power? Where do I get the strength? Where do I get the motivation? It's this relationship. And that's where I think if you wake up in the morning, I'm remembering there was the question, it can be 3 a.m., 4 a.m., it can be later, but we tend to do it at 4 o'clock in the morning because the vibrations in the world are very still, and it's a time for you and the lover of the soul. It's like that precious time to really establish a real, living, loving relationship with just another soul, but a soul that doesn't have a body or sense organs like me. And so it's a learning curve for all of us. You know, sometimes I think I'm a soul and I'm expressing, I'm talking to you at the moment. You can see me, I'm sitting here acting through my body. The divine, or Baba as we say, conscious living being, but does not have a body or sense organs. So it's renegotiating. But really, when that little factor in your life, it kickstarts a sense of willpower, discipline, and strength that allows you not to be so disturbed by others, situations, health problems, etc. And this is where I would really try to develop remembering during the day. Because if you just do it a bit morning and night, what happens during the day? And quite honestly, I often feel too that during the day, little actions disturb my mind. You know, I gossip, I criticize, I judge. So when I try to meditate, those little actions disturb my thinking. And that's why really, if I really want to improve my sense of consciousness, if I watch my behavior and actions throughout the day too, so that as I'm remembering more, I just feel I'm sustaining myself throughout the day. I meditate in the morning, I create an awareness in my mind, I remember, and during the day I keep topping up my connecting and remembering. The last bit was trauma, right?
Yeah, speak a little bit about trauma, because so many people are experiencing or discovering, you know, trauma in their lives right now, from past, you know. How does the meditation practice connect with that?
You know, this is, I think now a lot of the sciences of psychology, psychiatry, the whole main theme, and I'm certainly not a professional in that area, is that most behavior is trauma-informed. And, you know, all of us are sitting in this hall, and all of us carry our karmic story. There's so much beauty in that story, but there's so much trauma. And that trauma's like a shadow over my present. And, you know, the more I've understood this, the more I can have mercy for other people, because sometimes people's behavior seems so difficult, so inappropriate, and we're affected by it, and we're extremely judgmental. But the more you understand that I am trauma-informed, in the sense that my past, my life experiences influence how I behave in the present, so is everybody else's too. And ultimately, this life is almost, through the awareness of self and God, having a completely different context of my trauma that I'm carrying. That we all have done actions under the influence of ignorance, being body conscious, which has led me to this point, and all the emotions and stories and feelings inside. But I want to clear that. Ultimately, to me, meditation, I'm using that word, or remembrance, is three things. It's cooling down in the present, learning this, probably the most profound art of life, to use thoughts to cool myself down. Secondly, to heal the story of the past. And by healing, by understanding and clearing the effect of what is stored in my subconscious. And I think you've heard a lot about that in the last few days. So it's like I clear, I purify, I cleanse the subconscious. So the trauma has slowly, slowly less and less effect on my present. And thirdly, I do actions that create a positive future. I understand which actions create happiness and which sorrow. So in a sense, my spiritual journey is calming me down the present, healing my past, and empowering me for the future. But the important thing is that it's a lifelong journey. And I think that's, you know, I feel that we've all got responsibilities in life, but if this journey is in the background constantly with you, the learning of the self. And for me, over many, many years, I do experiments in the laboratory of my mind to convert what I know into what I feel. We know I'm a soul. Actually, all of us came here. We all knew we were a soul before we even came. But the journey is converting the knowledge that I'm this micro point sitting in the pituitary gland around there in the brain, so that I experience who I am and I unleash this incredible power of peace into my life. That's the journey. Remembering and practicing is converting what I know into what I feel. And sometimes I even think the first step is to know, the second step is to believe. The next 998 steps are educating myself to really feel who I am and have such a real relationship with the divine, as real as, you know, my friendship with Judy. We can see each other here. It's so real. That's when this spirituality really is powerful in your life, and you really feel that I have this internal strength to genuinely deal with sometimes seeming insurmountable issues and obstacles in life. Mm. It really can work, but consistency is so important.
That was a beautiful answer. Thank you for that. Okay, there's a whole set of questions here about the soul's relationship with its body, including the soul's relationship with the brain. So questions around, okay, what happens when there's a mental illness or some brain damage and the soul is functioning inside a brain that doesn't work so well? There's questions around, are we supposed to disconnect from the material world? Is the body a friend, or is it something to be transcended? Why have we got 5 sense organs if we don't get to use them to enjoy life? And we live in a very physical world, and we've got this ephemeral connection with a non-physical being. How do we manage that? So soul in body with brain in the physical. What is the relationship? Soul, what's the right posture to take? Posture of mind, attitude, and understanding to have here?
You know, I think that in a true spirituality is very grounded, actually. It's taking the highest principles and truths and meeting the reality of life. Why sometimes are we so unhappy? Because in a sense, it's not my body, it's my consciousness of my body that's deceiving me. And if you look at it, sometimes I think that, you know, my mind is just dancing to the tune of my sense organs, you know. I see someone's bad behavior, I let it in my eyes and I think. I hear a comment or a criticism, let in my ears, think. It's like the world is driving my mind. I've become submissive. And whatever is happening out there is driving how I feel inside. So the body is controlling the mind, so to speak. What we're learning here is in a way to really respect my body and understand it and how it's a wonderful instrument of the soul, but take back the authority of the self so that I, the soul, am the master of my body and my sense organs. So when I see the bad behavior, I don't let it dominate my emotions and my thinking, but I observe. I remain aware in my mind. I observe it. I can see it, but I don't overreact to it. So the body is an extraordinary instrument. And in a way, I think the more you learn who you are and experience who you are, it's like gently, with love and wisdom, you take back the authority of yourself, not through force and control. And it's almost like you sit up here, and many of you have met Daddy Jenki, I think, over the years, and she often used to say, I sit here and when there's a health problem, I talk to my body and care for it and work with it. You know, so that it's not about denying my body, but taking back the internal sovereignty that I've lost over a long period of time. So in a sense, that means too that my mind is not really dominated by my ego and my lack of self-respect, mm-hmm. which sort of dominates my thinking. So, you know, I think it's a really balanced view, how to really, you know, when you're detached too from your body in a way, you know what you need, you know what to eat, how much to eat, you know, in a very practical way, you sort of, this is a wonderful instrument. I have to care for it and look after it. But, you know, mental health, I'm certainly no expert in this area, and I'm sure there's many people here. You know, once I heard Daddy Jenki again say that, you know, there's hundreds of reasons why there's mental health issues. But you know what she said once, which touched me? The first is a lack of true love in this life. And the second is a lack of true love in a past life. And I really feel, you know, we're programmed to belong, to connect, to be in love. You know, it's a part, it's the heart of human life and existence. If we're living in this world so feeling so disconnected, unloved, not belonging, it distorts my perception, you know, of myself, of you, of life, of absolutely everything. But also, I think sometimes the intellect, which is the part of the faculty of the soul, and it's the intellect which is receiving the knowledge. But, you know, sometimes all that stuff in my subconscious, you know, we were calling it like trauma, etc., all the rubbish of the past, the intellect holds it back. And it's like a dam wall sometimes holding all this rubbish. You know, so on the surface we are very socially appropriate, but behind it all these feelings and stuff is happening. Sometimes the dam wall just can't take the pressure. Mm-hmm. So all this stuff just comes into my thinking and my behavior and so on. So perhaps like a little bit of a spiritual view of mental health. And in a way, I would say if you're body conscious, we all have relative mental health issues in a sense. We all do. And, you know, I think the whole of spirituality is just, I don't know, to me it's incredibly sensible sometimes. It's just learning who I am, taking the pressure off myself to look good, to become something, to impress people, just becoming who I am, accepting who I am, respecting who I am, loving who I am. And I just think things begin to normalize in a very sweet way.
I had a long-time friend who was a Buddhist from birth, and he began to experience depression. And it was interesting for me, studying the BK, that I understood that he was not his brain, but he did not. So he thought the mind and the brain were the same thing. So to admit that he was depressed, or that he had the, you know, illness of depression, he could not, because he felt like he was saying, I am somehow weak because my mind and my brain are the same. And when I shared with him as a student of the BKs that no, you're not your brain. You are the soul in the brain. And just like kidney illness requires kidney medicine, brain illness needs brain medicine. Mm. And it relieved him of the stigma, the shame. Mm. So that simple understanding of being soul is very helpful in these matters. And I like your long-term karma hangover or baggage is really what's expressing itself, isn't it?
It is. And you know, when we talk about depression in psychology, it's like a sadness, deep sadness that my dreams and life to be loved, respected, cared for hasn't happened. But spiritually, I think it's like a mourning for the loss of my true identity. I live my life, but who am I? Just when you really think, we're often adults with families, with children, with grandchildren, and I'm not clear really who I am. Mm-hmm. And it's like a massive identity crisis the whole planet has. It's like there's a crisis in the soul of humanity, because it's like we have so much knowledge out there and we're so uneducated about in here. Mm-hmm. And hence, you know, mental health is the biggest issue in the world today. Mm-hmm. Because the fundamental truth of who I am is not known, that I'm an eternal, immortal, non-physical point. That's the reality of existence. And when that seed is re-sown, the whole tree of life, my physical health, my mental health, starts to step by step heal itself. Mm-hmm. Just sow the right seed and the healing begins, the seed of truth, the healing begins to happen.
And some of the self-medicating we do, use of drugs, for instance, or other things, you can see the soul is desperately seeking for that original experience. So marijuana is very popular in Canada. And, you know, you can tell young people are just looking desperately for peace.
Yeah.
You know, and cocaine, they're looking for power. And, you know, you can just feel the soul craving something that it can't find, and then getting a substitute somehow, you know? It's very interesting how knowing you're a soul is at the root of healing so many things.
I think so. You know, I often use the analogy that the inner world's like a tree. Mm. And it has a seed, a trunk, branches and leaves. Your thoughts are the leaves. Mm-hmm. But your thoughts are the end product of the whole inner inner self. And often, you know, when we have chronic negative thoughts, or we try to cherry pick out, but just other ones come. Mm-hmm. And the branches are like your mental and emotional patterns, which are the habitual perfectionist stuff and paranoia stuff. The trunk is your subconscious, And Freud said that like 80 to 90% of your behavior emerges out of that place. But the seed is your sense of identity. Mm-hmm. And I feel what we're doing here is when the seed is false, that I'm a temporary body, it influences the trunk, the branches, and on the top, the chaotic thinking. Mm-hmm. And what we're doing is sowing a new seed. That seed influences your subconscious. It influences all your mental, emotional patterns. And on the top, your thinking is just automatically cooler. So it's the practice of who I am. The fundamental study of this university is to become soul conscious. And that's the idea, is to live my life but practice. As I walk, as I move, as I talk, as I do my work, just keep aware, and you start to build, rebuild that self-awareness. And I think the influence on all the things we've been talking about begins to happen.
How is it going out there? Is this useful? Pretty good, hey? Okay. About the five sense organs, you know, we do this really simple practice in the introduction course where we ask people, if the physical eyes are seeing, what is the soul doing? I ask you all. If the physical eyes are seeing, what is the soul doing? Observing. If the physical ears are hearing, what is the soul doing? Listening. Right? If the physical taste buds are firing up through eating, what is the soul doing? Enjoying. Right? Like each of the sense organs, we can separate the difference between the intentionality of the soul and the actual physicality of the sense organs. It's just a subtle shift, but that's our practice, is that I choose as the soul what I observe. I may see a million things every day with these eyes, but I choose what I observe. I choose what I listen to. Maybe not what I hear, but what I listen to. So we have these organs for a reason, but we understand we are not them. We are the masters. All right, we have lifestyle, family, and relations. Whole series of questions here. So overall question, do I go home and just blast my family with my newfound knowledge and make them all be caged? Do I go slowly and I kind of just ease into it and I demonstrate through my behavior? Maybe I don't use the God word day.
Judy, can we maybe go a bit one by one? Would that be okay?
Well, that's one question.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's the big picture question on this. How do I approach my life when I get back? And then there's a bunch of details, Charlie. Like marriage. What's the BK view on marriage? What about children? Where do they fit in the BK view
of
the
world? How much longer have we got for this interview?
What's the recommended path for marriage if you're already married? It's kind of like, what's our view on all of these things? How do I, when I become a BK, how do I ward off romantic interests? Sisters and brothers don't get married when they're BK, so how do we reproduce? So these are all questions related to BK lifestyle, and just how much of that do I want? How much do I understand? And, you know, how do I take it when I go back home to my existing family and relationships?
Does anyone want an early lunch? Oh, these questions. You know, one of my experiences on this journey is to respect the beauty of each individual, each soul. And I think spirituality is regaining self-respect, knowing my value. That's, in a way, that's what this journey is, taking back the value, my sense of self that I've lost, and then seeing the value in everybody. And that's where I think that when we go home, sometimes our enthusiasm, because we've had such an experience, but they haven't been here. So I think we have to be so respectful and sensitive. And, you know, I feel the most powerful form of sharing is just to be an example. You know, I mean, does anyone like being preached at? Anyone here like someone to preach to them? Not one's putting up their hand. No one likes it, but sometimes we can appear like that. So I feel that if your family or your friends really see that there's something shifted in you, and people are very observant, they will ask you, and that's the best thing I feel. Just be incredibly gentle. And you know, one of the things I feel in relationships is that, you know, the main question in all our centers in the whole world, no matter what culture, is how to deal with difficult people. Mm. I mean, most of us spend most of our mental time trying to sort through why others are like they are. That's just the human condition of today. The more you begin to understand yourself, your own past, who you are, there's a sense of compassion for others too, that everyone else is carrying their trauma. Everyone else is under the influence of their past. Everyone else is lacking self-value. And there's, I think, a more merciful attitude. And just because something is meaningful to me may not be meaningful to them. I really feel the way you influence others is to give love and respect genuinely to the soul. See the soul and give love and respect. That is the way to really pass on what you've experienced here. You know, the majority of the BKs in the world are married. I'm not married, but most BKs are married. And this whole life is sort of retaking back my self-awareness and my self-value while living in, you know, like taking responsibility and all the responsibilities I have in my life. Yes, you know, those of us who, you know, aren't married don't stay unmarried in that way. That's a choice, because it's not a force, or it's like I make a decision that my relationship is with the divine, because that's how real the relationship is. But personally, I have no expectation on anyone else. That's my decision for my life. Mm. And I love my life, but I know it's not for everybody. I know that the majority of people won't want to live like me at all. But I think what we try to do is live in this world and apply spiritual truth to myself, my relationships, and the way I work in life. Look at the world. I would say the main crisis out of thousands is human relationships. To me, that is the greatest need of the human spirit. And people aren't feeling the love and belonging I feel should be the first human right. It's such a pain in the heart of many. So there's something fundamentally wrong. Because when I am body conscious and you are body conscious, it's a recipe for massive differences and conflicts. And what spirituality says is begin the journey. I can't change you, but as I begin to heal myself, I can even change the dynamics in a relationship. Now, that's long-term work, there's no doubt about it. But really, as you change, you will shift things in your life as well. you know, I think that really have great respect for every type of person and their particular lifestyle. And what we're trying to learn here, no matter where you sit in the hierarchy of different family situations and whatever, is to learn about yourself, have a relationship with God, and apply that to your particularly unique set of circumstances. And I think if you keep practicing, the long-term effect is incredible. And that's my life experience. I've just been consistent. If there's one thing to take from here, I would say, do it every day. You know? And that I just think when you're consistent, you start to rebuild your spiritual power. But what life will do, life will say, no, you're too busy, this is more important, that's more important. No. I said the first thing is priority. When you prioritize, I have to really heal myself, give time to myself. If that's the main message you take away, to me that's a fantastic message. Give time to yourself on a daily basis and you will watch. And it's not like that, is it, Judy?
Mm-mm.
It's a bit like that.
Like the stock market.
Yeah. I don't think anyone's here is pretending that everything will become totally rosy. But when you have knowledge and you apply it to your life and start to practice and experience, there's no doubt in my experience that your life will start to improve and you'll feel more comfortable with who you are as a person. To me, that's success in life when you can say, I like being me, I'm comfortable with the sort of person I am.
Yeah.
Because I've been amazed in my life talking to people that are the so-called successful people. I never like that word in the world because it often means you're rich and powerful and famous. But scratch the surface and there's such a sense of self-doubt and self-dislike and, you know, these sorts of feelings are there. And, you know, to move out of that place and move into a sense of a relationship with yourself which is more kind and respectful, is a massive success in life. And that's what this journey is about.
When I began meditating, I was a single mom with two little girls. And I thought it was impossible that I could meditate because, you know, they were 3 and 5 and they were fighting and they needed mom's attention. And most moms know the 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock time after the day, we call it arsenic hour in Canada. It's that really, really challenging hour with children when they're totally overstimulated from their day, you're overstimulated from your day, a meal needs to be made, homework needs to be done, and how are you going to meditate? And I remember just deciding at 7 o'clock, I'm going to meditate every day. And of course, it was like World War III downstairs when Mom went away to meditate. And I lasted 6 minutes, and then I lasted 7 minutes, and then 10 minutes. And then I noticed, I think it took about 10 days, but by the end of that time, they were completely quiet. And I thought, well, maybe they've killed each other. And I went downstairs. And sure enough, they were just playing quietly in separate corners of the house. And then it became quiet time for them. But I really had to be determined for 10 days not to give it up. So, and I didn't think it would be possible, and it was. And now they're grown up, and when we're together, they'll say, Mom, it's 7:30. You're going to 7 o'clock, you're going to meditate? Like, so I think there are many, many stories for many students of the BKs where the family, of course, is our priority. We're not giving them up at all. But within that, can we make a little space for a practice that we value that brings benefit and that brings benefit to them as well? So that's very nice.
Can I just share something?
Yeah.
Because, you know, another common question is, you know, I'd love my children to do some of this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I feel that when we really meditate and practice, it automatically transmits to those I'm closest to. This is the amazing thing of the human soul, especially when you're close. It automatically influences, I think.
Yeah.
And I often think, too, that today, parents are so worried about children or family members. And, you know, there's two influences on a child, main influences. One is the family, the atmosphere, the parents' relationship. It's a whole dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
But the second is the karmic story carries. And, you know, sometimes I've seen some families that are such really loving, good families, but the karmic story in one of the children is, difficult. You know, the child just, it's hard, life is hard work from them. And then the parents really blame themselves, you know, why, what have we done? Why are the children like this, you know? And this is where I think sort of having the context of the soul's journey, this time we're in, it helps me understand these sorts of things in life. Because many, I remember one family when I was young, four children, three were sort of the high achiever types, so just did everything and reached the top, but one was absolutely the opposite. And the parents really took that on themselves. And then, and maybe there's some family dynamic, but you know, when we understand each soul, it doesn't mean we don't love them. We will still love and care for them just the same as the others. But it helps to put in context that actually we create the body. The soul comes, has its own journey. And the soul's carrying its past. And that's why sometimes that soul's behavior and approach to life is completely different. And it just helps me understand really all the things which are happening around me in life. Yeah.
I think that's connected to just a couple questions which were around attachment and judgment. So that's in relation to the relationships in our life. How do I overcome the critical judgments I have of others? Are these fundamentally just a reflection of my own flaws? And aren't we supposed to be around human beings and have love for human beings? But how do I do it right so it's not attachment?
I personally do feel that the more self-critical I am, the more that is projected on others around me. I think this whole life journey of accepting myself, if I'm really challenged of accepting someone in my life, one of the main reasons is I haven't fully accepted who I am, which is, as we said, the spiritual journey. And so that's sort of mental criticism. I feel the main way to tell how much ego I have is my attitude to other people. And if my mind is always finding fault, why are they like this, this is wrong, this is bad, to me that's one of the best measures of how my visual on others tells me how much sort of ego I really have. Because I think one of the main things I've learned from the Brahma Kumaris is the power of a mind full of good wishes and pure feelings. And that is the power that shifts relationships, shifts atmospheres, shifts old negative dynamics and heals. It's like using, I feel, seeing the value in another person. You have a choice. And I feel in life you have a choice. I can focus. All the weaknesses are real. They are there. It's real. But if I can still see them, but if I choose to see the value, to me this is the power of a parent's vision on a child or my vision on anyone. That if you hold the value of someone in your attitude, they can change. This is what leadership is. I personally feel leadership is knowing the goodness of another person, knowing their weakness too, but having this conscious decision, being aware of the weakness, but focusing and seeing the goodness. And that's what heals and brings out the beauty in other people. But one of the things I found too is that the second part, maybe you can...
Attachment. We're in human relationships, yeah. Loving others, but not being attached.
Well, this is a massive subject, and I often feel the most unpopular word in the English language is detachment. Everyone doesn't like it because it's, to me, it sounds like it's abrupt. It's like cutting off, disconnection, non-loving. But being uninfluenced is really, I would say, as the soul heals and becomes clean, I am naturally less and less influenced by vibrations of people, attitudes of people, behaviors of people. And that's absolute freedom. And perhaps we would say that is detachment. To me, there's two types. There's dependent love, which is the attached love, and there's the detached love. Actually, when you're detached, you can love people when they're sweet and they're good. But you can also love them when they go through their stuff. When you're dependent, the law says the more you're dependent on someone, the more they will affect you. And often, you know, we can be around some people, just their face, their vibration can impact me. But that's me. This is the beauty. Spirituality says I am responsible for how I feel. Yes, maybe their behavior is inappropriate, but I can't change them. And what I love about spirituality is I'm saying, yes, I'm responsible for my life and who I am and how I feel. I can project and blame for the rest of my life, but I'm deceiving myself. I'm moving out of truth into falsehood. But it's this real journey, and I really feel that you can't, in a sense, conquer attachment, if I can say that.
Mm.
You can only replace it. Because the weaker we became, because what happened, we became so empty, so weak, and so the more vulnerable I felt, I need to sort of have people to sort of depend on for my sense of security as a person. But the problem is I became so dependent on you, everything you do impacts on me. And so the more I rebuild myself and my relationship with God, almost naturally, I've found personally I feel less and less dependent on people, less and less affected by people. And quite frankly, you can genuinely love people when you're not so affected by them. Because the more you're affected, you love them one day and you're upset by them the next day. And it's an incredible journey. Because in one sense, the soul originally was non-dependent, even on the body. I'm an eternal soul, this is temporary, even relationships are temporary. As I came through time, I've become dependent on everything around me as I lost my spiritual power. And now I know who I am and I'm starting to reconnect, but I've got addiction, and I use that word purposefully, to so many things. People, you know, so many things I'm so dependent and addicted to. And so I think we have to be so patient with ourselves, you know, just I'm on the journey. But it's real freedom. The more I let go, I feel that I find for me, the closer I feel to God, naturally I feel less dependent. It's not that I'm trying to, you know, chant, I must be detached, you know. I don't think that works at all. But it's a natural consequence of rebuilding my inner world with who I am and who I belong to. The natural consequence is I feel less affected and dependent. But there's a but.
Oh.
It takes time.
Yeah, I was going to say, I asked Charlie this morning if he has any emotional reactions anymore. Can you imagine somebody saying no to that question? He said, no, not really. I said, no triggers? Nothing that gets you? No, he said, not really.
I did say a little bit.
A little bit. But the point being that this is over how many years? Because you weren't always like that. But it's happening for you because of your consistency. So that gives me hope. Okay, we have a couple more questions. Can you... Yeah, still good? Okay. This is the 5-in-1 question, you know. But this one is all around diversity and inclusion. So these questions, one of them is about what is the woman's role and how do BKs connect about the woman's issue? Another related, when I see countries at war and I notice that the heads of state are mostly men, do you think that the lack of women at the table of the world's power contributes to this problem? So
Judy,
this is a whole woman thing. Should we stop there on women? Okay, save the other two. Okay.
You know, I think yesterday, the day before, we've been talking about time. And to me, I feel there's an amazing shift happening, and that's why I think a lot of us feel so uncomfortable in this world, because everything is changing. And one of the shifts is, I would say, from west more back to east, from sort of a male dominance to more a female thing, and even from a materialist culture moving back to a spiritual. There's sort of these massive shifts happening in the psyche of 8 billion human beings, and it's very uncomfortable, because that's what, as we become soul conscious, I think one of the wonderful things about being aware that I'm a soul is that I realize that for balance I need male and female qualities, really. And I love this, an image which you may have seen, the image of Vishnu. Who's seen the image of Vishnu, can I ask? Most of us. And that has one head, two arms of male, two of female. And in a way, that's the symbol of family life in the future new world, the golden age as we understand it. And in a way, we need, all of us, the virtues, the qualities, perhaps the female side of our personality, and the action, the power of action, the male side. And maybe the whole world, men and women, have gone more into the sort of the male energy of life. Yeah. And spirituality is going back to nurturing, healing, re-emerging my inner beauty, my peace, my love, etc. So, yeah, it's true. And I do feel that what is symbolized by sometimes the leadership with a lot of ego is about control, dominance, power, force. But the leadership, I think, that comes out of soul consciousness is, you know, of love and belonging and humility, and that's real power. And really, some of the daddies, most of you, when I started, this organization had probably 80 to 100 of the older sisters who were the original students of the Brahma Kumaris. They were extraordinary because they were so humble, so simple, so sweet, but so spiritually powerful. And they were natural leaders, not that by skills and learning and education. They were leaders because they were leading themselves. They had taken back their inner sovereignty. And that's, you know, leaders today have got so much intellectual power, but not that. That's what I think people are yearning for, leaders who are examples, mm-hmm. who are just genuinely loving, humble, good human beings. It's very powerful. Daddy Prakashmani, who is head of the Brahma Kumaris for 38 years, once we were making a little bit of a film called Women in Leadership. I was with a few people, and we interviewed one of the Undersecretary Generals of the United Nations. And we asked him, who's the most impressive leader you've met? And he'd met Daddy. And he was dealing with all the leaders of the big nations of the world. He was the head of political affairs for the Secretary General. Straight away he said, Daddy Prakashmani. Because her leadership is her life. It's not sort of just intellectual and ideas. Her whole life, you know, is an example of respect and love. And I think there's an incredible shift. And, you know, the Brahma Kumaris, I think, is the world's largest spiritual group run by women. So it's unique, very unique.
Okay, two together here. Does the BK organization welcome LGBTQ? And will the Brahma Kumaris organization embrace greater diversity and inclusivity in its leadership and representation, reflecting its global growth and member diversity?
I think that what I love about here, we're all souls, and how we express through our body, whether it's LGBTQ+, whatever, it doesn't matter. I think what I've learned is to respect the soul. And to me, that's what the world needs, you know, just I respect myself as a soul, I look at you as a soul. And I think that benevolent vision is, you know, otherwise we feel judged, you know, and I think I think there's a massive identity crisis in the world, and that's why people are trying to grab on, where do I belong? Am I straight? Am I gay? Am I this? Am I that? You know? Mm-hmm. Because I have to identify somewhere. I have to belong somewhere, which is life. But actually, I'm a soul. Behind all these, I'm an eternal soul. And I think once I reconnect with that, then the whole picture of starts to become clear. But yes, I think for me, the BK is accept everybody, people of different religious backgrounds, non-religious backgrounds, all of the.
Okay, two more questions. Why do we use the red light? I thought I'd give you an easy one.
Well, the red light helps me become introvert. And sometimes, quite frankly, we want to learn to have this soul conscious practice, this remembrance of the divine in any situation. But initially, when we start to meditate, to have calming music, suitable environments, red lights, which sort of helps you go in, because I feel the greatest myth of life that we've all been indoctrinated with is peace, love and happiness is out there. And that's why when you sit to meditate, your mind just runs every single time. And a lot of us think, oh, I can't meditate because my mind, it's such a powerful myth. And so the red light just helps me internalize and start to create thoughts and feelings around who I am and unpack that experience. But it takes practice. And it's why, you know, I heard Daddy Jenki once say, you need three things on the spiritual journey. The first is patience. The second is patience. And what do you think the third one was? Oh, you're amazing. How clever. It's so true. I think start the journey, keep it up. That's the message from here. Mm. What you've experienced, you can experience more permanently if we practice.
Mm. Okay, two more. I keep finding such good ones, and they're in categories. This category was about connecting with God and making sure I'm not connecting with some other energy. Like, how do I know I'm connecting to God? And it's in the package here of questions. One of them is, what's our concept of the devil? Is it real? And in the West, we're taught spirituality is weak. How do we go up? Is this true? So this whole business about how do I know that I'm connecting to God, and are there other things I could connect to? Negative things? How do I know the difference?
I think when I have knowledge and I that God is a soul like me, that I'm a soul that has taken birth and rebirth, and I reap the fruit of my actions, I know happiness and sorrow. God is a soul like me, but has not had that experience, is constant, is never influenced, remains eternally pure, holds truth. And building up that picture, you know when you're connecting. And really I feel mainly I come under the influence of my own self, my own nature, my own path. That's the real influence mm-hmm. on the soul. And we are constantly sort of, you know, coming under that past, which is a whole filter through which I perceive everything in my life. The more I become the soul, connect with God, it's like I have a new perception, a new filter, that I start to interpret everything that's happening around me. So even if I'm sort of meditating and I come under the influence of myself, just keep practicing, or some energy, whatever you feel that may be. The main thing is not to be afraid, because fear makes you so weak. And I think one of the other healings of this journey is the more I experience the reality that I'm the eternal soul, and I always exist, the whole account of fear starts to lessen. That is real freedom. I honestly believe freedom is to be free from the numerous shopping list of fears that most of us have in life. And even the fear of death, we come to that point that it's just change, it's just change. And to be liberated from that, we intellectually believe it, but to move to the journey where I really, that's my life experience, it's incredibly powerful.
It's beautiful. Thank you. All right, and the last one. What is God saying about the future of the world? Will things get better or worse?
I'm sure it's lunchtime.
And I'm very sorry if we didn't get some of the other questions, because there were other ones, but I thought those are the ones.
You know, I think, being very open with you, that I feel, as you've heard, the understanding we have here is this is the confluence period of a culture of body consciousness which is self-destructive. Look at our world. I often feel the chaos out there, the madness we see in our world, where does it begin? It's because 8 billion people have an unhealthy relationship with self that flows into health, flows into relationships, flows into family, flows into politics, society. It's just there. And this upheaval is increasing at the moment. But we're rebuilding. What we're doing here is rebuilding a soul-conscious culture which is growing and growing. And that's the fabric to rebuild a new world. So the future could not be better, but the immediate present is going to be really challenging, deeply challenging. And I feel that many of us can feel that. And that's why I feel what we're learning here is to really, when we go home, we can be distracted in so many ways, but to really create that foundation. And I feel for me, what I often think is that I put down two anchors in my life, anchors that are solid and unshakable. Who am I and my relationship with God? And no matter how much this world spins around me, when those anchors are strong, I can manage. I can really manage. But, and that's why I also feel the more you put down those anchors for yourself, automatically your life or support the people you love, when everything they've had trust and value in starts to shake. You know, all the institutions and methods of life, which we've all been brought up with as what life is about, I feel almost everything's going to start shaking. But that's just the short term, because it's giving away to a new world based on soul consciousness.
Wow. So in the end, it's going to be okay. And if it's not okay, it's not the end. Thank you, Charlie. What do you think of that? Was that amazing? Wonderful. Wonderful answers. So rich, so deep, so wise, so practical. Thank you. Really beautiful. Yeah.